Welcome to the Marvel Cinematic University podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Canton III. We've been gone for a little bit, but we are here for a special occasion. I am here with my co-host, my pal, my buddy, my comrade, Jake Christie. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy to be back. I mean, always happy to be talking to you, AC.
Of course. And before we get into our guest, patreon.com/MCUniversityPod, where you could get our bonus content. We are doing the Mission Impossible series. Mission Impossible 3 is on deck. If you missed Mission Impossible 2 with Zach Harper, go check that out. Subscriber mailbag. Sometimes Jake and I will just riff on certain things. We have another one of those on the way. And Jake got some special cooking as far as the Oscars are concerned. Yeah. Our pal Michael Springthorpe. But enough about that. Let's get into our guest. He is a comic book writer, comic book creator, also been writing for a really long time. His name is Kevin Garcia. Kevin, welcome to the program. How are you doing, sir?
I feel very welcome, actually. Honored to be on here. I love MC University, and I love your guys' takes on stuff. I was re-listening to the Secret Invasion stuff just earlier today, and there were opinions to be had on that show.
Yeah.
Plenty. Plenty. Yeah. With the Marvel Cinematic Universe at that point was in a very dark place. And I think our opinions reflected that as we try to be as honest as we can regarding those things.
I feel like the thing we try to do, especially with something like that, is we are not unbiased observers. Like, we are rooting for the MCU to do well. So that's why, like, when we're criticizing it, it doesn't... Because sometimes it's like, okay, we get it. But, like, we really wanted that. We wanted that show to be good. We really wanted it to be good. And it just wasn't.
Yeah, I am known as a Marvel guy, but that does not mean it is beyond criticism. Yeah, I'm usually going to try to, like, well, it could work well this way. But there's certain things, you know, Secret Invasion, Eternals, some of these things that just don't work out the way they should.
Yeah.
Exactly. Before we officially get into what we wanted to talk to you about, I actually want to get your opinion on that specifically, because as somebody who's written Marvel comics and has been in the comics game and kind of seen how this is translated to the widescreen, how have you felt about the last couple of years? Because there's been a lot of criticism, there's been a lot of critique revolving around the MCU. How do you view it from your perspective as somebody who writes about these things?
All right. First off, to clarify my bona fides, I guess, is so I worked for Marvel for 10 years. I worked specifically for the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. So that means I did write for them. I mostly did research for them. But that means that it was my job to keep track of continuity and make things make sense when they don't, which is often. And I'm going to say something controversial about, you know, the last couple of years of the MCU, and that is it's not that much different from the first couple of years of the MCU. Like we look back on it and we're like, oh, those were all great. Like, they were great because we didn't have anything great to compare them to, first off. And second, they didn't have a plan in the early days. You know, best example of that I can give is The Incredible Hulk, which is the only MCU movie that I cannot rewatch because it's just that boring. You know, I could rewatch Eternals and get a grump about it. I have actually complained to people about Endgame, which I know is people think it's kind of weird on that one.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's got some of the best scenes in the whole series, but there's like overall that movie gets to me. But The Incredible Hulk is boring. It sets up things that were never going to be paid off. It references things they didn't have permission to reference. And on top of that, there's, you know, that scene where Bruce is delivering a pizza and the guy's like, I know who you are. And it's played by the guy that later on plays Peter Parker's teacher. But in the credits, he's Amadeus Cho. And there is no way they would have had him be Amadeus Cho if they had any intention of the MCU lasting more than four movies. So, you know, there wasn't a plan. And with that being said, you know, the good to bad ratio is not much different than it was before. The difference is there's a heck of a lot more eyes on it now. That's the difference.
Yeah, that's interesting when you put it that way, because I mean, to be quite honest, we have said in a lot of our episodes, like, regarding that, if you wanted to compare phases 1 and 2 to phase 4, there is a lot of the similar kind of, you know, fits and starts trying to find your way. Because if you really think about it, phase 4, you could equate it to rebuilding after a championship run if you wanted to equate it to sports.
It's basically a whole new phase one.
I also think, before we move on, I think a big I'm glad you said the thing about not having a plan, because that's the thing I harp on all the time as someone who, you know, famously, infamously at this point in the show, went to school for writing television, that I think people so greatly overestimate how much things are planned in television. Like, Jesse Pinkman was supposed to die at the end of season one of Breaking Bad, you know, like, it, and I think that if I would give advice to Marvel now, and I think you probably would agree based on what you have just said, like, I think they care way too much about plan now in comparison, because it, I think that the mistakes early on are easier to forgive when they're just messing around than when they're like, every single movie we put out is a pillar that this franchise is going to be built upon. And it's like,
yeah, one extra pillar. Anything.
Well, in that case, you know, like, I'm willing to forgive, you know, a movie like Blue Beetle for not being that good, because I know that it's not in service or anything larger. You know what I mean? Like, anyway, but I think that that's a great point, though, about, I think the ratio is about the same. It just, people didn't have the same expectations for The Incredible Hulk as they do for, you know, Eternals.
Yeah. And then, you know, Marvels, that one I feel like had a different thing against it, because I love that movie. I thought it was really good. And honestly,
agreed.
That movie felt to me like the most of any of the other Marvel movies recently, that one felt the most like it was made by people that love comics, because there were so many references to the comics. But, you know, a couple problems with that. Number one, if you weren't already reading Carol Danvers comics, you wouldn't get most of those references, and they may seem out of the blue. And number two, the biggest thing for me was the strike, because the last time Captain Marvel came out, there was a lot of this negativity, and all the fans came out to support them. The actors came out to defend, you know, all this stuff. But now, you know, the actors couldn't defend themselves, and the fans that would have supported them were also supporting the strike. And so the only voices in the room were the negative ones. So when the strike ended, literally the day before it came out, people had only heard negative stuff about it.
Yeah.
And when it finally showed up on streaming, people were like, hey, this movie was good.
Oh, pretty much. Yeah, it's pretty hilarious how that happened.
Yeah, it's I think the thing too is, like, and you mentioned something about the references. The thing about, like, the loving the comics is, like, I think people don't realize that I also famously, in the show's lore, started watching TV shows for grown-ups when I was very young, and I didn't get any references at all. But I could tell references were being made, and I knew that that was fun. And so, like, you can tell that a movie's made by someone who gets it, because there are a lot of specifics. And I feel like that's the thing about the Marvels, is it felt like, the fact that Nia DaCosta got the brunt of the criticism, clearly, like, put her heart and soul into that movie.
Yeah.
And of everyone I've ever heard talk about the process, she is the most clear-eyed about it. And it just frustrates me as someone who, like, lives on the internet and sees people all the time talking about how much they hate fakeness, yada, yada, yada. And the moment we have someone who's, like, being completely honest about what the process of working with a multi-billion-dollar corporation is making a movie, it's like, what, she doesn't even like this? It's like, no, she's being like you would be.
It really feels like they were throwing her under the bus.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a fair that's a fair thing to say. But on a more positive note, I would love to talk with you, Kevin, regarding your Kickstarter. You got the World War comics coming out.
Yeah, World War comics. Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that. As somebody who enjoys comics, is really into comics, and is always interested in finding new stuff, and has been happy about talking to different people in the industry in the past year or so, how did this come together, and what was your primary idea in bringing this to the forefront?
Well, I think the big thing when it comes to creating is making something you love, you know, create things about what you love, and they're going to be something fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
The last time I did a Kickstarter was when I did a book about the founding of what we call the Aztec Empire, because I was so tired of seeing all of these stories about, like, you know, Mexico, but it didn't matter till the Spaniards showed up, you know? So I wanted to do one that was 300 years before the Spaniards ever got there. And I had a lot of fun with that. I did tons of research for that book. But then for this one, it's something else that I love, which is comic book history. When I think about eras of comics, one of my favorite eras is the Golden Age. Not because the stories are good, but because there were no rules. They would just kind of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, a while back, a couple of years ago, and he says, you know, what if the Golden Age had happened today? And he was a comic book store owner at the time. And what he meant was, why couldn't we have comic sales like they had in the Golden Age? You know, when comics could sell $2 and $3 million an issue, you know, two or three million copies an issue. But what I thought was, well, what would it take for the Golden Age to happen today? And what would that mean? So I started kind of backtracking that. And I built this whole story around this idea of kind of reevaluating the Golden Age and looking at it through modern eyes. And then, you know, what if modern eyes were put into that situation? What would that mean? And then when I realized this was a story about history, I'd already kind of designed it around some original characters. And then I was like, no, this story needs existing characters. So that's why I started digging into the public domain. Because there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of characters in the just superheroes alone, you know, in the public domain, characters that anybody can use if they wanted to, that they belong to everybody. So I figured, all right, I can rub a couple serial numbers off and make them my own characters and then have fun with that, tell my own story. And that's what brought this up. World War Comics. It's all Golden Age characters and their legacies kind of looking back at you know, World War II, the good old days, and what exactly that meant, you know?
Mm. Now, what made you think that when you saw a public domain character, you didn't want to do the thing that the internet always finds funny, making him a slasher movie character?
So my day job is high school teacher, and I teach a journalism and publication class. And one of the things I cover all the time is copyright and trademark and things like that, public domain. You know, I tell the students when they're making something, you know, if you couldn't do it yourself, you could find a picture, but make sure you either have permission to use it, public domain, or you have a good case for fair use. And one thing I always tell them is, if anyone ever says, I have fair use, that person's an idiot. Because the only way you have fair use is if a judge said it in a case and you don't want it to get that far. So I tell them, you know, err on the side of public domain. What happens is a lot of people take that and just see it as, you know, I don't really know how they get to that. Let's put it this way. Night of the Living Dead is public domain. And it's public domain because of a mistake when they first premiered it. They did not correctly protect it via copyright as was required prior to 1976. As a result, you could at home just make a copy of it on DVD and sell that DVD legally anywhere you wanted to, right? But you could also make your own sequel if you wanted to. You could take those ideas if you wanted to. That's why The Walking Dead exists, right? The problem with things like Winnie the Pooh turning into a, you know, slasher creature, or Mickey Mouse turning into a slasher creature, is technically those could already have existed.
Yes.
Like porn parodies are a thing, right? Yeah. They're not making anything new. They're not actually taking advantage of public domain. All they're doing is taking advantage of the, I guess, the public interest of this character being public domain.
I appreciate you answering that question. That was a quick joke question. I was going to ask you a follow-up, but I appreciate that you basically used the joke question to answer the question I actually was going to ask.
It's incredible. Every single time Jake does the joke question, everybody gives him like great, legitimate answers. Yeah. And then is without.
I'm glad that we're, because that's always the thing. Beyond the fact that they already are public domain, the thing that always gets me is like, that is the laziest possible explanation. And it's also so funny too with a lot of the ones with like people were bringing up when Steamboat Willie became public domain, and they were using like different iconography from later Mickey Mouse shorts, and it's like, I hope to God you make this just so the mouse goes down your own creative ass.
So the way I look at it like this, I'm not Disney. I did work for them. I worked for Marvel when Disney purchased them. I was kind of part of that deal in a weird way. But I'm not Disney. But like, they're not really going to want to attack somebody for doing a horror parody or a porn parody because
Correct. All
that does is draw attention to that parody. Mm-hmm. Where it could be a problem is if you were to make the Steamboat Willie version of Mickey the main character in an ongoing story. Now there could be an issue because in any ongoing story, there is going to be points where you jump over that line and you have now maybe used something from later versions of Mickey. The thing is, they own the trademark in Mickey Mouse. They own a trademark to the shape of Mickey Mouse as a logo. Now, the trademark is not something for in a story, but it's something for on a cover, you know? And then they also own, they may not own the copyright to the original iteration of Mickey Mouse, but it's like Superman, okay?
Yeah.
Superman has been protected by DC Comics through its various, DC Comics has gone through other names over the years, but they've always owned Superman. And the thing is, there is a version of Superman that is public domain, and that's the Max Fleischer cartoons from the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But that version of Superman isn't a character that's public domain so much as those stories are public domain.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you were to, like, well, since the Max Fleischer version of Superman is public domain, I'm going to make it. they're going to sue you.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know how familiar you are with it, but I think I'm a saga I'm fascinated by, even though I've never actually seen the latter of these two movies. But the legal issues when they made Oz the Great and Powerful, the Sam Raimi movie, yeah, were like, because the books were public domain, but like literally, and AC, I don't know if you know this, but like the shade of green that the Wicked Witch of West is in the original movie, which, because the original movie is still copyrighted. So they had to make Mila Kunis a different shade of green, because legally, the Wicked Witch of the West having that shade of green was owned by Warner Brothers.
Wow.
Flat out, the shoes being ruby are owned by MGM.
The road couldn't be made to have yellow bricks.
The yellow bricks are in the original story. The issue is...
Sorry, like, well, right. It was something with the yellow road.
Yeah. So much of what... Like the little spiral bit of it. That's
yes, that's what it was.
So much of what the public associates with Wizard of Oz is from that movie, which, by the way, was a remake. I love pointing that out. Every time people are like, oh, there's so many remakes nowadays. The Wizard of Oz was a remake. The Thing was a remake, you know? And it's like, and by the way, I've only seen the original Thing. I've not actually seen John Carpenter's version.
I've only seen John Carpenter's version. So if AC's only seen the Mary Elizabeth Winstead one, we got a trio.
No, I only saw the old one. Yeah.
Well, no, you saw the second one. You didn't see the old
second one.
Yeah, the one from the 80s was the remake, because there was an earlier version of that same story. But what I'm saying is that, like, people may say that Wizard of Oz is public domain, and it is. You could do a lot of Wizard of Oz stories. I've read a lot of comics that use Wizard of Oz characters completely free without worrying about it. But the second you involve stuff from the MGM movie, there's an issue. A great example, Frankenstein. Frankenstein has been public domain for a long time, right? It was published in the 1800s, but early 1800s. But the green skin, flat top, bolt neck, that belongs to Universal. And if you were to do any of those features, that's Universal.
I also think, doesn't like the Igor assistant also belong to Universal? Because I recently watched the original Frankenstein for the first time.
Yes, but Igor doesn't actually appear on a film until Young Frankenstein.
I'm aware of that. Yeah, I know. Because I watched the Frankenstein movies, and I learned them. Like, where the hell is his assistant? Anyway, I got you way off base just because I'm interested in this stuff with the public domain.
Asking my students is easy to get me off track.
Yeah, but AC, I don't know about you, but I want to know about a little bit about some of these characters. You mentioned that there are 1,000 characters to pick from. How did you go about picking the ones you used?
So my big thing was I wanted the comic to be readable to people who had never read any of these comics, because obviously no one has. It's a brand new book, right? And so I figured the easy way to do that is keep the characters in simple archetypes. It's more about the story than about what powers they have. It's not about like, well, my guy can do this and that guy can do that, so who could win in a fight? It's not about that. You know, that stuff comes up, but it's about the story that's being told. So then I wanted to have very easily recognizable characters. So I wanted a guy who wears the flag, you know, and you know, does that. I wanted a guy that has a cape and everybody looks up to as the strongest guy there. But I also wanted a big shirtless guy that is literally the strongest one there is, you know? So I wanted all of these things. And I figured, all right, so let's go through the public domain, find characters that are fairly similar to the more popular ones, and then just make them even closer, you know, which is funny because, like, one of the characters that I use was originally Wonder Man, which was a character created by Will Eisner, the guy that the Eisners are named after. That's basically the comic book Oscars. And Wonder Man was created 1 year after Superman came out. And he's literally faster than a speeding bullet. He can leap tall buildings in single bound. He's more powerful than a locomotive, all that stuff. DC saw that first issue and said, no, cease and desist. And they actually went to court. And the company that published Wonder Man just never published a second issue with Wonder Man in it, ever. And the thing is, if you look back on it, other than those surface similarities I mentioned, Wonder Man's not that similar to Superman, really. But nowadays, every company out there has like 10 knockoff Supermans. I could name 5 off the top of my head just from Marvel. And then you know, Image has knockoff Supermans. Wildstorm had knockoff Supermans. And then they became part of DC where they have more knockoff Superman. So it's like, I said, all right, I'm going to take Wonder Man and make him even more like Superman, just so he can be my Superman, you know? And some of the characters are more general. Like I have one character who kind of fills both a Wonder Woman role and like a Thor role in one person. And for that, I wanted to have this iconic, you know, female hero. And the one I ended up picking, Wonder Man only ever had one issue. The one I ended up picking is a character called Farah, the living goddess, who is a Egyptian hero. She only ever had 2 pages ever. I'm going to turn her into one of my main characters. So I wanted characters that had a history so that if you wanted to go back and read stories about these characters, they've already been published. Those stories exist. But now I'm building off of them to get like, where are they 80 years later? What are they doing now? It's funny, for the Captain America character, there were a bunch of patriotic characters to choose from. But the one I picked, when I read his origin, I was just cracked. By the way, I read every story these guys were in before including them because I wanted to make sure that they made sense. The origin of this guy, who was called Yankee Doodle Jones, by the way, was this. There was a scientist. He was doing an experiment. He injected this guy with this chemical that made him super strong and the best person there was. But then these Nazis broke in and shot the scientist. And now there's only the familiar, right? Came out a year after Captain America. But here's where it's different. This one, there was no scrawny Steve Rogers. Instead, there were three wounded veterans who showed up and said, "We give our bodies to science." Then he cut them apart, sewed them together into one person. And you think, oh my God, he must be a Frankenstein. But no, literally the next panel has handsome blonde guy peek out and go, "Hi, boss, I'm ready." And I'm like, wow, okay, this is 1940 science. Let's do it.
Oh boy.
So he's my Captain America. And I call him, instead of Yankee Doodle Jones, which is very silly, I call him the more alliterative Yeoman Yankee. And I say that he is the highest ranking yeoman in the U.S. military. Yeoman is a really low rank in the Navy.
So when you think about building, you mentioned building off of the previous iterations of these characters, what goes into that from a thought process standpoint as a creator?
Well, I also have to think about like exactly what I said going in at the beginning, which is what does that mean today? You know, so like Farah, for example, Farah the Living Goddess was an African hero. She was super white. You know, all the characters in her story were white. And in fact, she was in a comic called Zegra Jungle Empress. And I went into this in one of my TikTok videos, but long story short, in Zegra's village, all of the women are drawn as attractive white ladies and all of the men are drawn as attractive black men. And there is a longer reason for that. Short version racism, but the point is that like unintentionally that comic showed one of the first interracial couples with a kid in a comic book. Wow. Unintentionally. And so I was like, if I'm going to reintroduce these characters, I want to use the more modern sensibilities of, well, she would be a woman of color. So Farah became Farian. And one of the very first things I said was she has to be a woman of color. That has to be what's happening. Similarly, my Hulk character is Zorro, the purple zombie. And they never showed what he looked like before he became the purple zombie. But he was a man wrongly convicted and sent to death row. And then after he became the purple zombie and killed a bunch of mafiosos and Nazi spies, they sent him to death row again. And he survived both times, technically. So I was like, you know, he's also a person of color. And I've also added more elements to these stories. You know, characters are gay who would not have been referenced at that as all in the 1940s, you know? And so they're still in their head looking back in the 1940s as if it was this idealized time when we in the present know that it really wasn't, you know? And so the idea was to have that kind of reevaluated both from the point of view of people that were there and remember it from 80 years ago and the point of view of people who have taken on the mantle of others who had made their name back in the 40s. You know, the modern day Superman, the modern day Batman, the modern day Flash. And they're like, wow, you know, the olden days must have been great because I always hear you guys talking about them. And kind of getting that to looking at that from another angle, I guess.
Now you can't have great heroes without having great villains. How do you bring those? How do you bring those to the forefront with these specific characters, especially with you adding these sensibilities, as you say, and having all of that fit the mold?
So that's the really funny part about this story. There are villains in this story, but most of this is about the heroes.
Okay.
Because it's about the people who see themselves as heroes or saw themselves as heroes and either reevaluate what happened before or dig their heels in deeper. You know, it's all about that. This is one issue. This issue is intended to be self-contained in the sense that it is literally the making of a documentary about World War II, where they're looking back on it. But ideally, this would be part of like a 6-issue story where they get to kind of live a modern recreation of the Golden Age. And that's where the bigger questions come in of, yeah, we all agree who the bad guys were, but does that mean the good guys were innocent? Like, we know, we know the bad guys of World War II were bad. There's no question there at all. But yeah, the U.S. was doing some stuff.
Well, at what point? Is it a day that ends in Y?
Yes.
I love self-introspective stories. So as you are describing this to me, it makes me smile because, you know, it's easy to go with the really deep, dark villain that has a complicated backstory that you can bring to the forefront and make it a huge deal and have these sprawling pages where they're going back and forth with not only dialogue, but fighting and action and stuff like that. But I think some of the best stories are told when the heroes have to look in the mirror and take a look back at everything that they've experienced or everything that they're going to experience. And how do they come to grips with decisions that they've made or decisions that they haven't made in certain instances? So that's why when you said that, I was like, oh, okay, this kind of grabs me a little bit. So it's very exciting to hear something like that.
You know what? The three most influential stories involving Iron Man throughout the decades, him dealing with alcoholism, him failing to protect his intellectual property, and him fighting his best friend. Like, those are his most influential stories in the comics. And that's what made them so good, because it was about that introspection. And by the way, I want to specify that I don't view this as a deconstruction like Watchmen. I've had some people who read the script compare it a little bit to Watchmen. I could see that, but I'm not just trying to say superheroes all suck and they don't know it, which is not necessarily what Watchmen was about, but I'm like, I'm not going that direction. It's more of like, I honestly believe, you know, the Captain America character or the Superman character can be good people, but you also have to be able to be a good person and acknowledge what has happened. You know what I mean?
Right. And there's gray areas. There's gray areas to everything. So you can be a good person, meaning to do well, but mistakes do happen on the way to being a hero. You just don't become a hero without there being certain decisions that you make that everything goes perfectly. And if that was the case, then we would never have good stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are some, you talk about, you know, the Golden Age of comics, and obviously I think people know about it from, like, when I think about it, I think of that as like the very, you know, corny sort of uber sincere type thing. But what are things that, as you were doing your research, you thought, like, you wish that comics and storytelling more broadly had today more in common with the Golden Age than what we have now?
Well, first off, I want to address that stereotype right there, because that idea of the corny, overly, like, self-important of, like, well, Commissioner, that kind of stuff really wasn't the Golden Age. That's the early Silver Age stuff. Excuse me. That's, you know, when DC was really leaning into it and Batman was like always there with Commissioner Gordon and that kind of stuff. In the 40s, that existed, but so did like literally everything else. I love the Golden Age of comic books for the same reason I love Victorian science fiction, because in both situations, they didn't know what the rules were yet. Right. So they were just throwing everything at the wall to see what stuck. One of the characters that gets brought up a lot from the Golden Age of comics, especially when we're talking about public domain, is a character called Stardust the Super Wizard, who, by the way, not part of this story right now, but I do have stuff I would want to do with him at some point, I guess. Stardust the Super Wizard literally does whatever popped into the creator's head at that particular second. Mm-hmm. Like, that guy had no filter. His very first appearance, he's like, you are all bad guys. I'm turning off gravity for all of you for a while. And then afterwards, he's like, you know what? You deserve to be skeletons. He waves his hand and they're all skeletons now. There's one point where like a bad guy's head gets squished onto the feet of him and they removes all the middle part. And he goes, you have to live like that now. And the bad guy's like, what the hell? You know? So it was nonsense. But there was also, you know, depth that was there that would surprise you. The Streak is an example for me. That's my Flash character. In the original comics, it was called the Silver Streak. And he's one of the first speedsters in comics, not predating the Flash, but one of the early ones. And let's be blunt. Most of the significant stories involving the Streak, Silver Streak, they don't age well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. His origin involves a swami in a turban hypnotizing him so he thinks he has powers. He then gets a super powered bird sidekick, which he got in a extremely racist story set in the Middle East. And then in the story that introduced his human sidekick, a little boy with powers, which, by the way, he goes, I'm going to inject my special fluid into you. And that's, anyway, that story involved a yellow peril bad guy, which is a racist stereotype of Asian people, East Asian people, right? So each of those important stories in his process, really racist. But what really solidified the fact that I wanted to use that character was a later creator took over Silver Streak, and this is still 1940s, it's still middle of the war. And in that first issue by that new creator, Don Rico was his name, the Streak and his human sidekick are just sitting there reading a newspaper, and he goes, they're hanging black people in the South? Why are they doing this? This isn't my America. And so literally, he and his sidekick run to the South and go after this fake KKK group, save a family from a lynching. And I'm like, this is unheard of in the 40s. Occasionally, right. You see comics that had the KKK as bad guys, but never in relation to racism. They were just Nazi sympathizers. But like, this was like dealing head. Literally, the first page of that story is a lynching. And I was like, what? I was shocked. And then the next issue by that same creator, literally the Streak goes after a capitalist and says, the only true American thing is to let your workers unionize. And I was like, okay.
You're goddamn right. You're goddamn right.
Salute to that. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Sorry. My cat wanted to join.
Oh, of course. We don't need to pause for it. We've had cats interrupt this show many times.
Fair enough. I have an elderly cat here, and she's gotten very talkative in her old age.
Oh, hashtag washed agenda.
You're washed agending a cat, AC?
What? It fits the bit. He's called it an elderly.
This is a new groundbreaking of washed agenda.
He said it.
I understand that, but you're saying it about an animal. You're saying you were, sorry. Kevin, this has been going on long before.
It applies to all, I
just want the listeners to see if they agree with me or not, that this is a watershed moment in the Washed Agenda saga, that he said it about an animal.
Listen, Washed Agenda is in all shapes and forms of life. People should embrace it, and I think people should appreciate it, and that's all I have to say about that. But Kevin, as we continue on, in terms of... You're selling this, you're having this Kickstarter, and you're wanting to put this out. If you had to say one specific reason, why should Person X buy this comic? Why should Person X be interested in delving into this particular story? What would be your reason?
I can't give you one. Because the issue is everybody's got to have their own thing they like. Right. Mm-hmm. I specifically designed these characters so that you could pick up the issue and immediately get, I know what that character's personality is. I understand that character's personality. I get what this character is doing right off the bat. But maybe you're somebody who wants to support indie creators, in which case I'm working with some indie artists. I'm an indie writer. I did work for Marvel, but I didn't get to create new characters for Marvel. They didn't let me do new stories. They said, flat out, if you want to do that, go do them on your own first. So you know what? Screw it. I'm doing it on my own. Maybe you want to see, I know a lot of people that like reading about the Golden Age, like reading about those stories from back in the good old days, and they want to know more about that. So yeah, look at that. Maybe you're somebody who's interested in history, in which case, go look at it from that point of view. Literally, the whole first issue is, how would superheroes have affected World War II? And one of my big issues, like DC, for example, DC was like, well, the Nazis had a magical thing that would not allow superheroes to invade Europe. No, forget that. Both sides had superpowers. Simple as that. Then everything still runs exactly the same as long as both sides had superpowers. And that's pretty straightforward. So whatever it is that gets you into this book, I want you there. But I feel like I can't give you one answer, because what may be good for one person is different for another person. With my last book, it was only about Mexican history and mythology and anthropology. So that was a very specific thing. Here it's like, no, there's a lot of reasons for somebody to like this.
You got a potpourri going.
Yeah, but there's a downside to that. And the downside of that, at least in my view, is this. It's still, they look like traditional superheroes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when it comes to crowdfunding, people tend to go for things that are a little bit off the beaten track, something weird, something monstrous, something sexy. Mm-hmm. And mine is just, I mean, they are weird and monstrous and sexy, but they're primarily superheroes. And I could see that being passe, I guess. But I mean, that's part of why I want to do the story, because I wanted to do a story about the past, and I can see that.
Yeah. And what I know the answer to this, but I'm a good host, so I'm teeing you up, which is, when is this running through, and what sort of rewards can people expect?
Fair enough. So I am bad with numbers. So I picked a date that I could remember, which was Valentine's Day to start. And then when it told me the ending date was March 15th, I was like, oh, Ides of March. And so I said, Valentine's Day to the Ides of March. Nice and easy to remember. I don't have to worry about numbers. When I told that to other people, they were like, when's the Ides of March? I'm like, I don't know. Google it. Don't worry about it. But but yeah, so it finishes on literally midnight on March 15th. So it really ends on March 14th. And in terms of rewards, I have... the comic book, we've got four covers by four artists that I've either worked with or known for a while. And each one has its own different flavor. For example, Carrie Callen, everybody who has ever seen comic book memes, you've seen his work at some point, even though you don't realize it. Because he had a lot of memes that were like parodies of 1940s and 1960s DC comics especially. And people flat out thought they were real, sharing them saying, can you believe they did this in the 40s? And no, that was his comic. They were just really funny. So he did a cover for me that's designed to look like it's one of those 1940s buy war bonds, you know, propaganda comics that were partially paid for by the government. And then I have the main cover. The first cover is done by a friend of mine named Freddie Lopez Jr. And Freddie, I had him, because he's this wonderful fantasy and sci-fi artist who does beautiful painted work. So I wanted him to do one that looks like an actual World War II propaganda poster, not comic propaganda, just regular old propaganda. And then I had Marcus Newsom, who does this his own comic called Lightning Strike. And he has a lot of like raw modern energy. And I wanted to put some of that energy into the legacy characters. So that Sergeant Wonder, the Streak, and by the way, I didn't say his name earlier, but the Blue Fury. And then finally, I have David Lujan, who is a friend of mine here in Austin, who just does unique art. Like, it's super realistic, but it's also uniquely his. And so for him, I didn't give him any instructions. I just said, these two characters have at it. And my Lord, he did a beautiful job. And so we have that. But aside from the alternate covers, I wanted something more. And originally I was going to do little postcards or something. And then Marcus actually said, well, what if you had trading cards? And I went too far with that. So I designed 9 cards to go with all the characters, plus like a team shot, essentially. And each card is really designed to be from like a different era of trading cards. So like for the 40s characters, it looks like it was published in the 40s through the 60s. For the legacy characters, it looks like the 90s DC and Marvel cards. None of them should look like exactly like another existing card layout, but definitely you're looking at it and be like, I recognize elements of that. And then for some characters that are kind of outside of time, I give them kind of like these Marvel Masterworks looking cards where they look at the little silver names and stuff. And then for my, you know, kind of wild card character in the story, I guess, right now, Zorro the Purple Zombie, he's got the most modern looking card of all, something that hasn't even been physically printed yet. And on these cards, on the reverse side of these cards, is actual information that, like, if these comics had been published for years, that information would have been on there. So there is extra information that's not part of the comic that is in the cards. You don't need the cards to read the comic or vice versa, but it's like fun when you're like, hey, wait a minute. I know what she's doing because it says on the card what she does. Background, that weird little pose she's doing, that's what that's about, you know?
And I will say, this is a thing that you can't say, but as someone who has thought about backing Kickstarters before, I will say this is one of those that is close enough to its reward that it's not like spitting in the wind, that it actually will happen if enough of you guys back it. Which is, you know, I know you can't say, but you don't talk about it. You see a Kickstarter and you're like, I want to support this, but this is never going to happen. It's not even worth putting in my credit card information.
It's already drawn. Ronaldo Garza is doing the interior art. He's already drawn all the pages of the book. Michael Woods, he's only colored the first 10. I told him to hold off on the others until, you know, it goes through. But all the pages are done. The script's been written for over 2 years. Mm-hmm. It's ready to go. It just needs the funding. And I'm a teacher. So I only,
of course,
you know, I feel you. Yeah. Somebody the other day was like, oh, what if you put in a bunch of your own money? I'm like, I literally have. The amount I'm asking for is after all the money that I put in beforehand.
Yeah. The last one from me is, and I like to ask creators these questions at the end. What would you tell somebody who is trying to get into this as far as Because there's oftentimes that people run into roadblocks. They're not sure if they want to continue, even though they're really passionate about it, for a lot of the things that you just stated, as far as whether it's funding or things of that nature, finding people to help you out in that manner. What would you tell somebody who's trying to get into creating comics and things along those lines?
Well, I mean, the simple part is create. You know, I know it sounds silly to say, but like, it's true. And I think a big part of that is the world has changed in terms of being an indie creator. All right. Back in the 80s and 90s, people would talk about vanity press, and it was basically a dirty word. It was basically like, oh, you're self-publishing because nobody would publish you. But then in the 2000s, it's really become an idea of self-publishing because you chose to, or you want to, or that kind of thing. But more than that, you know, with the internet, web comics are a thing. And now, especially, webtoons are a thing. So like, while this one, I really want it to be a physical book, because it literally, it's about comic history. So the idea is making it about the history of the book, so making it feel like a book. But like, if you have a story, put it in a webtoon. And you're like, well, I don't draw very well. You know, I got some characters you should learn about, you know. You've heard of One Punch Man, right? Have you seen the original One Punch Man comics? Like, the original creator of it was not really an artist, and he just drew off the top of his head. They were just so funny, people wanted to read it. So then they hired another artist to redraw his stuff, and then, yeah, cool. But like, literally, he just posted these silly comics online, and they were so popular, it became one of the biggest manga and anime, you know, in Japan at the time. And then, you know, I've had some people tell me, well, I can't even draw stick figures. Have you heard of XKCD? This guy makes all of his money. Randall Monroe makes all of his money on stick figures. You know, it's doable. Yeah. You just have to be able to make it. Now, for me, for this one, I really wanted to have other artists involved, and that means paying them. So like, a lot of the money I put in so far has been paying them in advance. But like, I want to keep the, I want to see this through to the end. I want to make this happen. And that's something I want to do. Somebody, when I posted one of my videos, responded, your earnestness makes me want to back you. And I'm like, well, I'm glad.
I mean, you know this because you said you've listened, but this is a place to be earnest. It's a place where I believe I once described myself as a schmaltzy cornball, which is a thing that I'll remember that Anthony Mays appreciated a lot. But yeah, I think that's the earnest energy. I see your TikToks. I don't really know most of what you're talking about because I didn't grow up on comics, but you have great energy. I mean, I could have guessed you were a teacher just by listening to you speak for 3 minutes, honestly. That's not an insult. I mean, that is a nice thing.
No, it's fair. Depending on the TikTok, I try to make it as explanatory as possible. So sometimes it's something deep. Like, I just recently posted one where I was angry about a recent Fantastic Four comic. I do give background on the characters, yes. But it also, you'd have to read the comic.
I'm exaggerating when I say I don't get it. I'm just saying that it's like, you know.
Right. No, but I get what you're saying. And my thing is like, I feel like comics should be an entry for anyone. There's a saying, you know, I think Stanley actually said this, that any comic could be somebody's first. And so I try to approach things from that point of view of like, well, all right, let me explain to you from the beginning why public domain this and who this character is and why that, you know?
Perfect.
So I'm fine with that.
Wonderful stuff, Kevin. Kevin Garcia, World's War Comics, the Kickstarter. Available till March 15th or March 14th, as he says.
Well, midnight,
Kevin, appreciate you for joining us.
Obviously, the link is going to be in the description. That's, it kind of goes without saying, but the link, please consider supporting. There's a lot of levels. I personally, when my paycheck hits tomorrow, will be getting the Kerry Callan cover, because that looks cool.
And Kevin, of course, give us where we can find you, where we can find your work, all over. Give us the full entire shebang.
Sure. Well, I am primarily found on TikTok, which people who know me call me a Luddite. So that's actually very weird that I would have gravitated to that platform of all of them. But I feel comfortable on it. I feel like the community is pretty nice there. And I get to the, it's one of those things where I can do badly on a video and it's like, that's fine. That's expected for TikTok. And there I am at KevinGarcia_com. I am also on Instagram, although less frequently, also at KevinGarcia_com. And it is actually called that because I own KevinGarcia.com. All the other Kevin Garcias have to put something else on their name for their URL. I bought it for myself as a birthday present years ago.
Honestly, great, great birth. Because just when I was emailing you and it was at KevinGarcia.com, I'm like, this is professional. Like, this is like, grown-ups do this.
Yeah. Technically, I had it at garcia@commandercia.com for a while for an email, but I just, haven't used that email in a bit. So I'm there. I also, World's War Comics, as soon as I had this idea, I knew that I wanted to go somewhere further with it. So I actually bought the URL, worldswarcomics.com, well before I ever started this. So that takes you now directly to the Kickstarter. I will say, though, that I love talking about anything comics. So if somebody goes to my TikTok or whatever and they're like, hey, tell me about so-and-so, it'll be added to the list. I may not get to it immediately because I am still a teacher and I have a lot of things going on, but add it to the list. I got some weird requests sometimes.
Yeah, and I just want to give a quick shout out to, I don't know what you would refer to as, but we got a couple of weeks ago, we got a thing, while we were setting this up, I didn't want to say anything, that Alexis May, who referred to you as her fella, she's a loyal member of our Discord, she's a patron, she was like, salute. My fella Kevin Garcia is launching a Kickstarter, and I'm thinking to myself, ha ha ha, she doesn't even know that we're emailing about this already.
yeah, Alexis is my partner, and it's as soon as I launched the Kickstarter, I actually was on TikTok Live telling people I'm launching it right now, and had some people asking me random comic book questions like who would win in a fight, Wolverine or Batman, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and she told me she was going to be asleep an hour earlier, and she already passed out. And as soon as I launched it, it said, you know, first backer, and it was her.
That's wonderful.
Nice, wonderful stuff, man. Appreciate you joining us this evening, Jake Christie. Where can we follow you, sir?
You can follow me on Twitter at TheJKChristie. Please listen to my other podcast, Love It First Psych, where me and Andre Barrera are watching the show Psych. Almost done with season 5. Exciting stuff. Sean and Juliet are finally together. Praise be.
You'd love to see it. You can follow me on Twitter at AnthonyCanton_3. Follow the show at MC University Pod on all platforms, Instagram. We also have the TikTok, which we occasionally use, but also the... we have the YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe to that, as this will be on that channel. And of course, as I mentioned, patreon.com/MCUniversityPod, where all the bonus content I alluded to earlier, $3 gets you into the Discord and all of the backload of all of our previous bonus episodes, which we're getting up there in terms of bonus episodes for couple years. So
you're paying like 4 cents an episode.
Well worth it. I know at least one of those Patreon episodes had an amazing guest on it.
Yes, it was a great conversation about Spider-Man and the Latinx community. Was a little Kevin Garcia action was on there. Yes, that's how we first connected.
Absolutely. And so appreciate everybody for supporting us there, and appreciate everybody for supporting us soon. Don't worry, we will be back soon, because X-Men 97 is not too far away.
Nope.
So we will be getting into that. I might have an idea of how to preview that thing before it comes out. But in the meantime, keep it locked. MC University Pod, Kevin Garcia, Jake Christie. I'm Anthony Canton III. This has been Marvel Cinematic University, and we will talk to you next time.